Titus 1:5-11. I left you on the island of Crete so you can complete our work here and appoint elders in each town as I instructed you. An elder must live a blameless life. He must be faithful to his wife and his children must be believers who don't have a reputation for being wild or rebellious. A church leader is a manager of God's household, so he must live a blameless life. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered. He must not be a heavy drinker, violent, or dishonest with money. Rather, he must enjoy having guests in his home, and he must love what is good. He must live wisely and be just. He must live a devout and disciplined life. He must have a strong belief in the trustworthy message he was taught, then he will be able to encourage others with wholesome teaching and show those who oppose it where they are wrong. For there are many rebellious people who engage in useless talk and deceive others. This is especially true of those who insist on circumcision for salvation. They must be silenced because they are turning whole families away from the truth by their false teaching, and they do it only for money.
As we're entering into a period of time, we're going to be looking out from amongst us to see about individuals who may be able to serve as elders here at Westside, it's appropriate to think about qualifications, to think about what the scriptures have to say about what is needful for one to serve in that capacity. We find in Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3 those qualifications listed. Now, they're not a different list. They're covering the same information. They're talking about the same office. They're considering those qualities that are required and necessary for one to serve as that position that the Lord has given and set forth to be done. Some of the terminology may be slightly different. There may be some explanations that are offered that help to understand the others as we make a comparison. But as we look at both lists, it just helps us understand and comprehend fully what the Lord expects and what the Lord requires. Now, what I want to do in this next slide sort of addresses this idea. And Joe, is that there for advancing it? Okay, thank you, sir. In this slide, I put here the approach we're going to take. And I'm going to explain that a little bit from the standpoint that many times we start to look at these qualifications, and I know this is a fact because I've done it this way previously, to take it, and you sort of divide it up into two categories. You touch on a few other things, but you divide it up into two categories. You have those spiritual qualifications, you have those physical qualifications. And certainly there's an element of that that's noted, that is observable, that certainly needs to be explored and considered. But as you look at it this way, you take each part and piece and examine it by itself somewhat. You might look at some even controversial elements attached to it, and you start wrestling with some areas that have to do with these qualifications. And so what I want to do this time is a little different. What you find in these qualifications, both in Titus 1, which was the scripture reading, 1 Timothy 3, which we'll make reference to, provides a composite description of the qualities and requirements which are necessary, intertwined, and mutually dependent for serving in the eldership of the Lord's church. Now, what I mean by that is that you look at the totality of it, consider the totality in order to get a proper image, in order to see it correctly and appropriately. Now, I know the pieces, parts are part of that, but I wanted to try to see how we could approach it from the standpoint of the composite. Have you ever been to some place and maybe an amusement park, and there's this artist over there, and the artist, you can go over there and he'll sketch you, and he sketches you in a kind of comical fashion, doesn't he? He kind of exaggerates some feature of yours. And you look at it and you take it off. You know, of course, you pay them a little bit in order to do that so you can have a little comical sketch of yourself. So, but there's this. Well, let's contrast that with the idea of a police artist who is wanting to get information because they've got somebody that they're wanting to try to find. And you're a witness, and he's going to talk to the witnesses and get a description. He wants that description so he can make a composite, that he can get as closely as possible to the exact description, the way this person looks, so that they can identify them and bring them to justice. So an individual looks at it, and they start talking about the nose, and the nose is just the huge. Now, maybe the nose is big, but I mean, it becomes distorted. all this is about this, and pretty soon the image doesn't have any clarity. It sort of loses the ability to identify the individual because somebody got caught up so heavily on the nose that they don't see the description. They don't see what the person looks like. And so, consequently, I want us to kind of examine this, and let me approach it from this perspective and think about it this way. There are terms referring to and describing the office. As we look at these terms, we'll take the terms, the descriptions of it, and look at some of these qualifications and what's being noted. Steward. Now, steward's not one that immediately would come to our minds, I think, as a general rule. We have some other terms that we'll look at. But the idea of steward is found here. As you noticed when we looked over at Titus chapter 1, and let me read verse 7, "For a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God." Then it goes on from there. So he says it's a steward, as a steward of God. That's not so much a qualification as a description. I submit to you that it has implicit in it certain things that have to do with how one is to conduct themselves. And so a quality as it relates to the character of the person is going to be observable and can be touched upon as it involves some of these other qualifying indicators and various terms that are used to describe what this person is to be like. But that's not, he says, as a steward of God, this is what you're going to do. This is what is going to be entailed in this work. You're going to be a steward. And we know a steward is a manager, a caretaker of that which belongs to another. There are a number of references in Scripture that talk about stewards, stewardship, those who failed as it relates to being good stewards and held accountable for their failure in regard to this, the physical possessions that belong to the one who has given charge to the individual to oversee it. You think about in the Old Testament, Joseph was a steward over Potiphar's things. He was trustworthy, as we know, and see that he saw that he fulfilled those obligations. Of course, God was with him. So he was a steward. In that respect, you look over here at 1 Corinthians 4. In 1 Corinthians 4, it uses it to describe it in the context of that which is spiritual, not the idea of the physical, which is noted and gives us an understanding of what a steward does, manages and cares for things that belong to someone else. But here, as Paul writes, he's talking about some responsibilities as one who is a minister of the Lord and an apostle. Let a man so consider us as servants of God, of Christ, and stewards of the mysteries of God, that teaching, that proclamation. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful, trustworthy, to carry it out. So here we can take that reference and make an observation about this and apply it in the spiritual realm as a steward. So what does this help us understand further, besides just defining it, besides considering these things? It acknowledges that the Lord's headship rule, and elders are subservient to him in a subservient position. It knows that Jesus Christ is the head of his church, and he's the Savior of the body. He's put in that role because of who he is. He has absolute authority, as we find in Ephesians 5, 23 and 24. When we look at those verses and talk about the husband-wife relationship, which is correct, that's really illustrated to talk about Christ and his church and the relationship. So Christ is the head of the church, and the church is subject to Christ. The church is to follow him. That's everybody in the church. Nobody's exempted from that. Nobody can usurp that role or that position. They don't have the right to do that. And that includes the individuals that are in the position serving as elders. They are to be stewards of that which belongs to another. And who does the church belong to? Jesus Christ our Lord. In 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, and we'll have occasion to kind of reference 1 Peter as we go through what we are looking at this morning. What we find is that Peter himself was an elder. He gave some instructions. And in so giving these instructions, he gives them some understanding of what the role and the position requires and what's the expectations. But he also concludes with a warning. And he goes back to the idea of stewardship. The elders who are among you, I exhort, I, who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion but willingly, not for dishonest gain but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. Now we'll talk about this descriptions or referencing points about what's required, some ideas behind that, of course, the qualifications that are associated with it that demonstrate that this person has that correct understanding and proper appreciation and how they conduct themselves and how they're going to deal with their responsibility. But notice verse 4, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. So you do those things, here's the chief shepherd. So who's that? It's Christ. So who are we ultimately accountable to? Everyone is. But as we're thinking about this position, to fulfill that role correctly, to understand the requirements properly, is that we are accountable to the Lord. He's in charge. I've made this reference before, some of you may have recall it, but I think it's appropriate at this point. There was an incident that I was told about years ago down in Oklahoma, and the congregation, I was talking to this preacher friend of mine, and he had preached it over at a location. There was an individual who was kind of well known in the area, sort of a person that created problems and difficulties because of the way he handled himself. But one Sunday, the preacher was there in the foyer, some other people milling around. This individual came through the doors, and just almost the first thing out of his mouth was, "Who's in charge here?" My preacher friend said, "The Lord is. The Lord's in charge." And we should never forget that. And when we think about being a steward, then stewardship, and we're stewards, all of us are stewards in some capacity in varying ways, but when we're talking about this position, we're stewards over the Lord's church. It's His church. We are to be caretakers, and we are to then manage what belongs to the Lord. Let me notice the next point here. It precludes being self-willed or dictatorial, and one must be self-controlled. See, you start looking at the terms, and now you start kind of applying it, and you start seeing this composite and how these things fit together. And while we could talk about these things, and rightly so, and appropriately as you look at it, I'm in no way trying to minimize the need to look at these various qualifications and delve into them and understand them correctly, but let's see how it fits together in this way. And you think about being a steward. Being a steward, self-willedness, being dictatorial, is not something that is going to be seen in one that understands that they were a steward. And their attitude and behavior, as they're being looked at and considered, what kind of disposition do they have? And is that the type of thing that they're going to then bring in to that role? When you, again, turn to Titus, the first chapter, and notice with me, there, as we see this referencing to it, for a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God. We know that. Not self-willed, not quick-tempered. He goes on there in verse 8, hospitable, a lover of what is good, just, holy, self-controlled, under control of self. Thus not the quick-tempered, the disposition that flares up, being able to handle themselves in the various ways in which they're going to have to do in order to conduct themselves as a steward of the Lord, as they fulfill that responsibility in that oversight capacity. In 1 Timothy 3, we noted that there in 1 Timothy, the third chapter, is the list that's also found there. So we'll notice as we go along, referring back to this, He describes a bishop must then, in verse 2 of the third chapter, be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate. That word temperate is translated some versions as self-controlled, and that's what it means, temperate. So sober-minded, good behavior, hospitable, and continues on from there. The idea of this dictatorial disposition, remember what we noted in 1 Peter 5 when Peter was writing and talking about that he himself is an elder and here's how he wants to conduct themselves, to be that example. And he noted this idea that would be the disposition where one is not overbearing, that this is not the way in which one is to conduct themselves in a way that is going to then have this disposition of lording it over the church, as he says, nor as being lords over those entrusted. The entrusting? Who's entrusting it to you? The Lord, your stewards. Nor being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. In 3 John, there's a fellow, Diotrephes. Diotrephes loved to have the preeminence. And John had to rebuke him for that. His disposition was totally wrong. It doesn't say that he was an elder. It doesn't identify his position, whether a preacher, an elder, a member of that has some prominence, whatever. The fact is, this individual loved to have the preeminence, and he lorded it over the church. He was dictatorial. These things were going on that were not right, and he was forcing these things upon the brethren, and incidentally, the brethren were allowing it, or it wouldn't have happened. Wasn't correct, and John rebuked that. So it precludes being self-willed, dictatorial, lording it over others. One has to have self-control and demonstrate the self-control that they have in their life to deal with these issues. So a steward, one last point on that, desire. Here in 1 Timothy 3, Titus doesn't use the term desire. Again, I think it's inferred, but it doesn't use the idea. So we find in 1 Timothy 3:1, when giving these qualifications, as Paul writes to both Timothy, the evangelist, and Titus, the evangelist, to set these principles forth, he says, this is a faithful saying, if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. So this word desire comes up, and it's worth kind of pursuing a little bit, because we just talked about not self-willed. We talked about not being dictatorial, not lording it over others. So this idea of desire. And so we need to understand the concept of desire. It's a wanting. It certainly has that understanding. When we think about desire, it's something that is noted. I mean, it's almost some word which we recognize immediately what it means. But how do we reconcile then a desire with not self-willed? And what's the difference associated with that? And how do we then take that to understand what is going on when he says desire? Well, it's not the idea that I want this so bad I'm going to do anything to get it. And I want to be in charge. And that's the disposition of that self-willedness and the one who has a dictatorial attitude. The desire is, and he says, you know, if you desire this position, you desire a good work. It's the willingness, having prepared oneself, to fulfill the work, to fulfill the stewardship, to accomplish the task. That's the desire. That's what we see, and that's what these qualities will demonstrate and show of the character of the person under consideration. So when you hear about certain instances where somebody wants it and they're going to stand up and they're going to demand that they be put in that position, they're saying, because I desire it. They must apply the term desire and certainly take it out of the context of everything else that's going on that involves the activity and the stewardship the Lord has given those ones to do as it relates to His church. Let's look at another term that we see. Elder. Titus 1 verse 5. Interestingly, 1 Timothy 3 doesn't use that word elder. We typically use the word elder. Over the years, the elder, the position of elder. I've got my title, Elder Qualifications, last week, Selecting Elders. You know, you pick that one out. I suspect there's a number of reasons why, through the years, we kind of have taken that one more than the others. And part of it is because of the misuse of these terms that have been done among religious groups, denominations. And so we kind of do this. The other terms are equally applicable and appropriate and proper. But just who's doing this? He says, so an elder in 1 Timothy, or rather Titus 1 there in verse 5, for this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. Very quickly, without going back and re-going through a sermon and delving into it, just as a recollection and remembrance of what we talked about last week, these evangelists' responsibility was to teach these qualifications. You go to Acts 6, the church looked out from among them. The qualifications were taught, the instructions are given, what these qualifications would be in these settings. Now we're looking at that of elders. And so they taught this. So you set an order. You as an evangelist are to teach it so people know what it is, and so that they can go through a process in which the church can, from among themselves, select individuals who meet these qualifications. So older, demonstrating spiritual maturity, wisdom, and experience. So that's the criteria if you start looking at it, older. So how do I ascertain some of that? What's going to be done? And again, notice some things that involve these qualifications. Not a novice. Now, interestingly enough, being a novice has nothing to do with physical age in this instance, does it? When you think about a novice in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 6, it uses this expression, not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. So being a novice, there's a number of factors that come into play here, and that also the qualifications would require to be evaluated. How much knowledge and understanding of scriptures do they have so that they can fill their role and their responsibility? A novice, not a new convert. Now, that again, you look at that expression and what that would entail and, you know, how that would be fit into the equation, but they're not a new convert. And the idea of putting them in a position of prominence all of a sudden when they're not prepared for it, what do? Well, look at me. And it's a matter of pride, arrogance, and look at what I've accomplished and look what they've done for me type thing. That's not the attitude. So not a novice, lest they be puffed up. Older, knowledgeable Christian. They have knowledge, they have understanding, they have comprehension, they have experience. 2 Peter 2, verse 2, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word that you may grow thereby. You think about Hebrews 5 and 12 through 14. The rebuke there by the inspired writer was when you should be able to teach others, you have need to be taught yourself. They didn't have enough knowledge because they had not grown spiritually like they should in order to be able to take God's word and make the application. They still had to be taught. They should have grown. They're not equipped to discern good from evil, to take the applications of these principles and truths. You need to be taught and you should be teaching. So you see this, that not a novice helps at least explain some elements of this idea that having to do with older, that's demonstrating spiritual maturity, wisdom, and experience. There's nothing, having faithful children. This helps then make some evaluations, doesn't it? Having faithful children. Titus 1 verse 6 uses that expression. And notice this, if a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. Timothy does not use faithful children. It does make reference similarly to what you find there in the third chapter there. And we notice there in verse 12 is a contrast. You go to 1 Timothy 3 and verse 4, it says, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. So you have this description. There's some things associated with that that tells you something about them. And we'll look at that a little bit additionally in a bit. I want to tackle that aspect of what that means and what that conveys in a different one of our words that we're going to be considering. But let's just look at this thing, having faithful children. Timothy, what does faithful mean? Now, there's this discussion that comes up that I've encountered. Years ago, in another place, I was having a conversation with a member of the congregation, and we got into a discussion of elders. And one thing, as we got into it, he argued that faithful was not faithful, as I would immediately think and would argue, to the Lord, but faithful to the Father. So not insubordinate, you know, not rebellious, these types of things, faithful to the Lord. So he and I had a number of discussions over time, just looking at this. It was something I hadn't run across. Since that time, I've read some different information and materials that I've seen in the religious publications and kind of some of the commentaries that from brethren, and looked at this thing, and it's still considering what's described in regard to this. And I'm going, well, you know, faithful, one thing, just dropping down to that latter part, and I'll come back to the other contrast with the deacon's children who could be younger. You see, in 1 Timothy 3:12, the deacons have to have the children, but the children aren't, as Titus 1 tells us, believing or faithful children. What it simply says there, let deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children in their own house as well. So what's the distinction between these two? Well, Titus says and gives us some insights to help us understand even 1 Timothy 3 and what's inferred there. They've got to be old enough to be able to obey the gospel. And that they're faithful to the Lord. And the very idea of being older to fit that qualification so that they have children that come to that point in time, then that helps us see that, okay, this is a person's experience. There's some things that we are able to observe. There are individuals who show certain aspects of life that help us ascertain some things about the abilities to, in regard to their work and what their responsibilities as elders would be. So there's a contrast. So getting back to my story, because I hadn't forgotten, when we had this conversation, I finally said to him, you know, we talk about this thing. Ephesians 6:4 says, notes there, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. What more important thing does anybody have as one who is a Christian, a child of God, raising their children? What's the most important obligation they have? Teach their children about the Lord so they can be obedient to the Lord and serve the Lord in this life. You know what he said? I agree with that, and that's why I think an elder has to have children or the faithful in that sense to the Lord, but I just come from a different direction. So we came to the same point in just a different direction, and I thought, why did I have this ongoing discussion for this length of time? Why did we have this? Why didn't you just say that? Now, I could still take the faithful and still apply it to the Lord, but if you get to that point where we have agreement in the practical application of it, we're good. Anyway, so faithful to the Lord. What's the responsibility? Look at the obligation. Like I said, we'll look at some other things here. There are a couple other ones, and I'm going to do these together, kind of touch these together, and then look at some aspects of this. Bishop. Here's the word bishop, and what you see with bishop. In Titus 1, where we already saw Titus uses the idea of being left in Crete, Titus left in Crete to sit in order of those things that are lacking in appointing elders. Then you look a little bit further here. We notice where he uses in the word bishop for verse 7, for a bishop must be blameless, a steward of God, etc. So he uses the word bishop. Over in 1 Timothy 3, in verses 1 and 2, which we note here, there is a faithful saying, if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. We notice that. A bishop must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, etc. So here's this word bishop used. And what does a bishop mean? Overseer. A guardian or superintendent. It gives a description of what the role is going to consist of. It gives a further understanding and comprehension of what that entails. And so we find over in Hebrews 13 that relationship that's observable between that one in the position as a bishop, elder, and the church, and how the regard is supposed to be observable between the two. And so in verse 17, obey those who rule over you, and be submissive. For they watch out for your souls as those who must give account. We've already talked about the account. Who's giving account to? The chief shepherd, as Peter referred to the Lord, to give an account. And it goes on to say, let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. We're all doing trying to accomplish the same thing and make heaven our eternal abode. We're going to honor the Lord and do His bidding, and we're trying to work together on this. And so in this capacity, we're not vying for position or prominence. What we're doing is seeking ways in which we can do the things that the Lord has given in the manner and way which He desires to be done to accomplish the ultimate end. And so we are together. So just as being submissive, and what we've already seen is you cannot be dictatorial, being the examples, we find then that any kind of delegated authority, which the Lord has supreme authority, all other authority is delegated. Delegated authority is under the Lord. And so now you do it as the Lord describes it and sets it forth. And the dealing with the brethren in the right way, the idea of being submissive to that oversight, guardianship, because they care about you. Now, we're going to talk about that a little bit more, but just to touch on this idea, what's bishop? Here's another term that we find. Pastor. Now, here again is one of these instances where the term is so misapplied in the denominational world that you sort of shy away from it. And I understand that. I recognize it. You almost feel like any time something comes up like this, at least from my position, I have to sort of explain and do this. Now, since I've been for a number of years serving as an elder as well, actually the designation applies, but they're not using it the way that the scriptures describe it. They're talking about a preacher as opposed to that one who's really under consideration, and that is the elder, the bishop. The shepherd, he's a shepherd. He feeds and protects the flock, the church. So we think about in Acts 20 and verse 28, when Paul has the Ephesian elders with him, he calls them together, he's giving them instructions as an apostle, as he's setting forth these things, as Luke records this for our admonition and teaching and instruction. What Paul instructs as it relates to the elders' role and obligation, and he says, feed the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. Feed the church of God. Now, to feed, feeding involves a number of things. And it also has this concept of caring for and protecting and seeing to the flock. So the pastor, Ephesians 4:11 talks about these various offices. Some of those offices no longer exist, such as apostles and prophets, because they had to do with spiritual gifts, they had to do with the miraculous, and that no longer occurs. But these others are still present because we still read about them. For the church is functioning, he's given this organizational arrangement for the mature church to be able to go and do as he desires it to do. So the mature church has, as we find Philippians 1:1, you have those that are the saints, all Christians. You have those that are the bishops and the deacons. Mature church. So shepherding, overseeing, the pastor, the bishop, these terms. So let's look then a little further. Manage their house. I said I'd get back to this idea a little bit because referring to the way that sort of tackles some of this, again, I'm not saying it's wrong to do it that way. I'm just chose to do it this other way because I was hopeful that we could sort of see a composite, sort of get a sense of the totality of it as much as possible that you can when you're trying to analyze a list of the different qualifications. They manage their house. So we find 1 Timothy 3 and verse 5. We've read these verses, but I want to reread them at this point to emphasize. For if man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Titus 1, there in verse 6. If a man is blameless, the husband and wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. So to manage. And so, why is that qualification there? Why is it this idea? We talked about faithful children. They're old enough to be obedient to the gospel, a plan. They've obeyed the gospel. They are following and hearing that. Why then is that found? Can we kind of see the wisdom of the Lord in doing that? Sometimes we just do it. The Lord says to do it. We may not be able to fathom it. We may not be able to understand it if He explained it to us. But we're content that the Lord said to do it. But other cases, we can kind of see the wisdom. We can understand why things are done the way they are. And so down the stream of time, here's the church. And how are you going to be able to assess a person's ability to be in that role as elder? How are we going to be able to evaluate properly and correctly? What standard are we going to be able to use? The home. We can look in the home to see how this individual is managing his household and see the consequences and results of that. And from that, we can see with these other qualities and qualifications, an opportunity to assess. We have an objective standard. I can't look in the hearts of people, but I can know about their life to the extent that we're acquainted with each other. I can start seeing some things about aspects of their life that are known or knowable. I can start seeing and observing these types of things. And so now I have this in order to be able to assess it. Do you think Paul would have been a good elder? I'll just kind of throw that question out there. The Apostle Paul, would he have been a good elder? He was apostle of the Lord. He had these spiritual gifts. He had great insights, the Holy Spirit guiding him. Do you think the Apostle Paul could have given the instructions needful to guide a flock of the Lord's people and be able to be very effective in accomplishing that? Well, absolutely. I mean, nobody's going to deny that. But the qualifications were given not for a period of time when the spiritual gifts are there and the apostles are around or in the infancy of the church. And in fact, the elders, when they're selected, are being selected on the very basis, I would submit to you, because we have these lists, the list for what Titus was said, you remain in Crete, so you can set things, or things that are lacking in point elders in every church. And Timothy here is going around. You have this list so you know how to identify these individuals who will serve in this capacity. And so you take that, and down the stream of time, we're able to see and make these evaluations based upon the family. That's why it's important. Just like assessing the idea of faithful. What does it tell us about the individual? If a person cannot raise children that are obedient to the Lord, how is he going to be able to be that spiritual overseer for the church? Pretty important question, don't you think? Able to teach. The idea of to teach in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2. Some translations, apt to teach, able to teach, knowledgeable, know and teach truth. They have a knowledge of God's truth. And they do so for the care and for the protection of the church. The idea of the church and being able to accomplish these things as bishops and pastors and the other terminology that you start employing, you have these there areas to manage, able to teach, you have to know, you have to have care for and protect the church. And the care is very relevant. Now, you start looking at these, again, qualifications, and start reading through this, and it's the composite. Not ripping out one part, or putting such an idea here that you don't see the whole, but begin to assess this. You look at here, Titus chapter 1, and looking at verse 7, as it considers these matters, for a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught. So now, knowing, understanding, holding fast that faithful word, trustworthy word, that he can hold it fast. Well, you got to be knowledgeable in order to do that. These other terms that precede that, you know, that we're going to look at in reading this, having to do with this idea that it's going to involve care. But now, knowledge, comprehension. They may be able to assign doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. What's going to happen? Well, the church can be at risk. As one who is a shepherd, a pastor, you're going to protect the sheep. What's part of the problem or danger? False teachings out there. People want to bring in error. Who's going to protect the sheep? Who's going to? The person that's knowledgeable has the ability to step forth and be able to contradict those who are trying to be disruptive and draw disciples away. He goes on and talks there in this context about, for there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision. Of course, that was an incident then. There are other things that have all down through the stream of time have infiltrated the church that have knowledge and understanding of these things in order to protect the church and help teach and instruct, to bring help the members to understand what's right, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. You go back to 1 Timothy in the 3rd chapter in verse 3. That list, and here's some terms that sometimes are employed to help, you know, we take them together. And the explanations, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle. Not quarrelsome. It goes on with other terms. Gentle. Well, what has that got to do with this other thing? Well, able to teach, to stand forth, to contend for that faith, Jude 3, that has the knowledge and has the understanding, has the experience from the understanding and teaching instruction that has been received and have grown to that spiritual ability, that maturity that's observable in regard to these things, that they can then know the truth and uphold that truth, but in gentle, being gentle. Gentleness is not contradictory to this, trying to help people understand. Now, sometimes firmness is demanded. And sometimes people take the idea, well, they're gentle and they're trying to be considerate, and they sort of take that and try to run with it and say, wait a minute, no, you can't go there. It's got to stop. But it's got the same behind it, the same purpose and reasoning, is to uphold the truth and help that individual to have their souls right with the Lord. And that we be doing what's right. And that the congregation be protected from individuals who may be involved in wrongful things and may be bringing in error. Care for the flock. Tend the flock. See to the flock. It means you have to know the truth and have to know the flock. You have to have some awareness of things. That matters come to you, and you start to have to wrestle through with it and deal with it, but you do so in the manner that the Scriptures teach. You want to make sure that things are what's right, so it takes time, it takes effort, it requires work. The person who wants to desire that better be prepared to work and not just sit around thinking we're going to make decisions. That's not the essence of what the responsibility consists of. Does elders make decisions? Yes. But I can assure you there are a lot of people we can turn to, in fact, get input, and they make suggestions and recommendations, and their recommendations far exceed the thoughts that I would have. And I said, that's a better idea. Let's do that. But who's going to tend the flock? Who's going to see to the spiritual well-being of the congregation? Who's going to protect the flock from error creeping in and leading others astray or causing problems within the church? In Galatians 6 and verse 2, kind of to illustrate this, it doesn't talk about elders here, but it certainly notes those that would be in a position of understanding and knowledge and being spiritually what they ought to be. And that would certainly entail elders, would it not? So he's finding in Galatians 6 and verse 1, brethren, if man is overtaken in a trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such one spirit of gentleness. We saw that word, didn't we? Back is one of the qualities that is to be observable in an elder. Not self-will, not, you know, overbearing, not, no, gentle. I'm going to lead you to what's right. Now, if you're not going to do right, then we're going to have to take action in regard to those things and deal with it. But no, I want to restore one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ, to bear one another's burdens. That area and that responsibility, it's not exclusively that of elders because of those that are spiritual, but I submit to you that it's an absolute essentiality for one that's going to serve in that capacity, is it not? Because the qualities themselves demand it. Now, the lesson, trying to look at the composite, there's a lot of different things that come up, and I know there's questions that can arise and discussions that can be seen, things that need to be looked at and worked through because of the practical nature. The qualifications are very high. They're intended to be high, but they can be reached. I mentioned about Paul would have been an excellent elder, except he was unqualified, only because he didn't have a wife and children and didn't fit that qualification. Peter said he was an elder. And just as a point of reference, as I close the lesson for you to consider, what do you think about Peter as an elder? Peter's pretty impetuous at times, wasn't he? We certainly have a record of Peter having failed in instances, don't we? I mean, even denying the Lord, that's before he becomes an apostle. Well, he was an apostle, but before Acts chapter 2 and the establishment of the church and the events that follow after that, he was specially selected of the Lord. And the Lord himself, after his resurrection, had talked to Peter and said, "Feed my flock," as that one that was going to be an apostle and responsibility. And so we see later in Galatians 2, Paul had to confront him and withstand him to the face because he had been hypocritical in his behavior towards certain Christians. Whereas he showed favoritism toward those that have come from Judaism, he had distanced himself from those that had the Gentile backgrounds, but they're all Christians, and he had to be rebuked for that. Somebody says, you know, that's a pretty tough thing to look at this individual and then turn around, and in 1 Peter 5, he's writing about being an elder. What do you think of the character of Peter? Well, being impetuous and trying to work on things, and he has things to deal with. Do you think that the Lord would have picked somebody who was not exemplary as far as situations? I understand Judas. He's the exception. But Judas was picked because he would be the betrayer. The Lord knew his heart as well. But do you think the Lord would pick? Look at what responsibility he gave to Peter. Peter, certainly, he was married. He had a mother-in-law. We understand he would have children. They would be children that would be old enough to be those that are following the Lord, doing his will. You've got this whole process is observable there. Peter served as an elder. What do you think Peter did? Galatians 2 does not tell us. How do you think Peter responded when Paul confronted him to the face? I ask that question because I think it's imperative for us to appreciate what we would conclude based on Peter's character. Because that's the posit. That's the entirety. That's looking at all these qualities and qualifications. And where you may have this area, you know, he's wrestling with things. What do you think Peter did and how he responded to that? Well, nobody's going to tell me what to do, and you're not going to... Did you know I'm impossible before you were? And I walked with the Lord. You can't tell me these things. I have absolute power and authority. The Lord gave it to me himself. Was that the character and behavior of Peter? No. We see instances and times when he was confronted with things. What did he do? He repented. Genuinely repented. Was grievously sorrowful. Did not try to justify his behavior, but was grievously sorrowful for doing that which was wrong toward the Lord and toward the others. I submit to you, we don't have the record of it, but we know the character of Peter. How do we know the character? Because it's sketched out for us. Peter regretted what he did. Peter corrected what he did. Genuinely, sorrowfully made it right. Made things right with the brethren that he had not done right toward. And made things right with the Lord. Because Peter wanted to do what was right. Peter had the qualities that would be consistent with an elder. Even when you see instances when it didn't quite measure up at times, but he was going to make things right because we see the entire character of Peter. Not one snapshot that doesn't give us the full understanding and correct appreciation. Well, the lesson is yours. I went maybe a few minutes over time. I hope, trust you, don't hold that against me. I hope that I can just ask for forgiveness and you'll accept it on that part. But I'm not overly sorrowful that I went over, though. So that's kind of makes it difficult. But we're about to sing a song of encouragement. And the one thing that we want to, as we sing the song of encouragement, is look at our own lives to ensure we're serving the Lord faithfully. Because in the final analysis, all these other things are only intended to get us to a certain point that we can stand right with the Lord so we can make heaven our eternal abode. And if you're not right with the Lord this very morning, we beseech you, we beg you, we implore you to get right. In any way we can assist you in that endeavor, won't you please come forward and make your request known as together we stand and sing.